I'm Frank Vaughn. It's June 13th, Friday the 13th, 2025. And I think last night we witnessed one of the most masterful decapitation campaigns ever launched by a nation that was not the United States. Speaking, of course, of the Israeli strikes on Iran, and dispensing with something right out the gate, the Americans knew. They fully coordinated with the Israelis. And it's not just the pizza, although this tells you that everybody was working late because the pizza shops around the Pentagon were very busy. It's also now Trump's words confirming this morning. 2 months ago, I gave Iran a 60-day ultimatum to make a deal. They should have done it. Today is day 61. I told them what to do, but they just couldn't get there. Now they have perhaps a second chance. It's an interesting framing. However, Israel seems to have successfully neutralized Iran's ability to defend its own airspace. There's been a lot of noise made about the fact that the Russians were selling the Iranians some of their most advanced air defense systems. They seem to have been nullified successfully by Mossad, one of the most powerful intelligence agencies in the world. Israel seems to have mastery of Iranian airspace, and Iran's response was 100 drones that everybody knew was coming. They knew exactly where they were, and they intercepted and shot them all down. There was no ballistic missile barrage. There was no cruise missile barrage. So I would read from that Iran's ability to respond has been either completely neutralized or significantly reduced, or it's the fact that the Israelis managed to take out their command structure, and they may not have been able to execute the orders of the Ayatollah. It looks like Iran has been neutralized. Now, I just want to talk about a couple tweets I made, because a mistake I continue to make is trying to fit complex thoughts into 270 characters to keep it all on one post that's visible without anybody having to click on it when I post on X. So we're going to break it down. Let's do this one first. Israel contradicting Rubio on prior knowledge and coordination. I believe Israel over Rubio. But taking such a public position against Rubio indicates Israel is more than willing to paint an X on American targets for Iran so as to bring the U.S. directly into the action. This is pretty much the closest thing to a miss that I've got, because if America was coordinating with Israel the entire time, which it appears they are, if America is willing to defend Israel in the case of a counterattack, which they are, if America is willing to offer negotiations, continuing negotiations to Iran. Can you imagine? And I'm really trying to just parse this. I'm not trying to defend Iran and the regime. They have been systematically taken apart by Israel. First Hamas, then Hezbollah, then what's happening in Syria right now, which I don't think Jalani's going to last. I think he's useful to Israeli and Western interests for the moment, but I don't think it's going to last forever. But that's a whole other point to parse later. And finally, Yemen and the Houthis, which were bombed, I won't say into oblivion, but bombed into backing off by the Trump administration. These are all satellites of Iran. And forgive me if I'm a little halting. I continue to have a problem. I don't think it's contagious because nobody else in my house is getting it. If I am not significantly improved by Monday morning, I may actually have to see a doctor for the first time in many years. But systematically, Iran's satellite network has been deconstructed. And then last night, it was time for Iran itself. Now, Rubio was clearly lying here. The Americans knew. It's not just the pizza. It's also Trump's words. Very clearly, there was prior knowledge. And it seems very clear that the United States used its diplomatic position to throw Iran off the scent, that even though there was a lot of rumors of an impending strike in every single signal diplomatically, with the Americans warning their embassies, everybody making preparations, signaling to Iran that nothing was going to happen, leaving their guard down. Now, some have said if Iran had the capacity to respond to Israel, they would have done it back during the October, what do you want to call it, the October crisis, where Israel struck at Iran, Iran threw some stuff back, and it was kind of a tit for tat, and then everything went quiet again. I don't think that's true. I think Iran possessed the capacity to respond at that point and decided not to, so as to avoid disrupting the ongoing diplomacy to their detriment. Because now, I believe, their ability to defend Iran has been neutralized. I don't think they have that ability anymore. Now, something else I said, and again, this is where trying to throw so many things into one tweet at one time creates a lot of misunderstanding, and I'm going to have to think about this. This was, trying to communicate on Twitter, I think I'm better on video. Israel is operating well outside the bounds of defense. That is true. Now, they view Iran's actions with Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis as an existential crisis, and it is. I know there's going to be some anti-Israeli haters out there who might disagree with that, but I mean, the expressed written purpose of Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis is the destruction of Israel. So whether you like Israel or not, you have to acknowledge that the plan, which has been under development for decades, funded and arming and undermining the Lebanese government and all the various aspects, has a specific aim, which is the destruction of Israel. It's their publicly stated goals. Whether it's realistic or not doesn't matter. However, that defensive justification, now you, and this is an appropriate observation, that a powerful offense is the best defense, which is clearly Israel's plan. However, Israel's setting itself up to be the dominant power in the region, more powerful than any other nation. Now, you could argue they've already been there, but this is the fruition of that. Hezbollah has indicated that they're not going to engage with Israel. What's left of Hezbollah, because if people remember the mass pager and cell phone incident where all of these explosive devices were detonated in a coordinated way and destroyed a lot of their command and control ability and reduced their confidence in their ability to wage a campaign against Israel in the first place, step by step. If you look at this from a military and intelligence standpoint, what Israel's done here is masterful, and it's destroyed the morale of their enemies. However, when I say they're outside the bounds of defense, what I mean is they are setting themselves up as the premier regional power, and you can it's very difficult to argue that they have an expansionist plan in place. And I think once this Iranian thing's done, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, the expansion into Syria is almost inevitable. I think Jalani's being set up to fall later. And what he's doing in Syria is laying the groundwork. It was no mistake that the Israelis, when the Syrian government fell, when the Assad regime fell, they bombed out of existence the Syrian army and their supplies because they did not want that to fall in Jalani's hands. But there's a lot of internal drama going on in Syria right now that is largely ignored by Western media. And in fact, it is funded by the West. I think later on down the road, this is going to serve Israeli interests. Now, the issue is, I want to go to the last sentence here, which is Israel has no capacity short of nuclear to finish war with Iran. What I mean there is they cannot occupy Iran. Nobody's in a position right now to do so. The Americans have to, there has not been a troop buildup like you would have seen before the Iraq invasion, significant enough to even try and occupy such a big country. So there's that. Israel is not going to occupy Iran any more than Iran could ever occupy Israel. The best that they could ever do was lob missiles and bombs at each other. But what's changed is that Israel has seemed to have denigrated their capacity to respond to such a degree that they have mastery over the airspace. Now, this is not targeting, like, there's this myth that this is just about neutralizing Iranian nuclear forces, or they're not nuclear forces, but their ability to develop nuclear forces. Clearly, it's not. I mean, when you target their military leadership successfully, taking out a number of top officials, plus lower tier officials, which and your ability to bomb and diminish the air force and the missile forces to such a degree that Iran was incapable last night of launching ballistic missiles. You're far beyond just eliminating the nuclear program, and those bombings are going to continue today. Netanyahu came out, very clearly indicated that this is a plan that's going to go on, that there's going to be more. It's not over yet. So it's not just about Iranian nuclear forces. It has to move into the territory of regime change. And I think that's what you're going to see next. The end of the Ayatollahs and something else rising in its place. For the people of Iran, even those who are against the Ayatollahs, I don't know if it's a good thing, because you have to look at the backdrop. Are things better for the Syrian people now that Assad is gone? Are things better for the Libyan people now that Gaddafi's gone? I shouldn't say now that. That's over a decade ago. Are things better for the Iraqi people post-Hussein? It doesn't seem to get better for the nation's people when Western-backed regime change comes to town. Remains to be seen. But I don't think Israel is concerned with Persian or Arab welfare. They're concerned with building out the power base and, in their minds, defending the Israeli state. I also highlighted how Polyev, and this is a quote, he actually said this, "A strike on Iran would be a gift from the Jewish state to humanity." One of the places where Polyev's foreign policy differs from Carney's is he is much more pro-Israel, very overt about it. I think it ties into his renewed focus, or new focus, depending on how you want to score it, doesn't matter, on a reduction, or I should say a limit, on the population of Canada. I mean, I welcome that kind of rhetoric. I don't know where it was during the election campaign, but I digress. I want to keep this focused. Canada has been engaged in a multi-decade effort to import extremism, a lot of it that has been funded by Iran. We have created a large Palestinian diaspora right here in this country. We have created a large Arab diaspora right here in this country. And a significant percentage of that population is infected with the very extremist views that threaten Western civilization in Europe and in North America. We welcome it. We launder their money. We give them a place to set up operations. And from here, they send terrorists into the United States far more easily than they enter the United States from Mexico. And this is very much a liberal NDP creation. It's very much their legacy. Now, it would appear that Polyev opposes that. And I think from a Canadian perspective, once again, I have to highlight the fact that in this conflict, it's not the Jews who are burning our buildings, who are taking over our streets, who are destroying property, who are engaged in destruction, who are calling for the death of America, the death of Canada. It's not the Jews boycotting Arab businesses. It's not the Jews preventing Arab businesses from functioning. It's the other side. It's the Palestinian flag wavers. Not a single Canadian flag in sight. There's a difference. From a Canadian perspective, there's a vast difference between the Jewish diaspora's behavior and that of the Palestinian diasporas and the Arab diaspora. This is something that Canada is going to have to sort out at some point. We're going to have to make some choices. And I also, again, four separate points. And when I wrote it, I knew what I was doing, and I knew it was going to be confusing. The people of the world are in grave danger wherever they are. This has to do with the fact that the Americans used their diplomatic power to deceive the Iranians over the course of weeks and months so that their guard was down, so that Israel had the maximum chance of success. The Americans are basically saying, and Trump is basically saying to the Iranians, we've shot at you. Israel has done the shooting. It's like if you picture Iran being your house, there's somebody firing automatic weapons into your house, destroying your property and smashing everything. There's this great big force behind the person doing the shooting, and they're saying, we helped them pick the targets to aim at. If you fire back, we're going to defend them. But we welcome you to come to the negotiating table. And at the same time, before the shooting started, the Americans were indicating to Iran that there was going to be no shooting. I think that's as close to direct involvement as you're going to get without firing the guns yourself. When it comes to the war in Ukraine, I don't see how this doesn't undermine. Sorry for the jump edits. My lungs are not going to give me much more today. I don't see how this doesn't undermine the Russians' ability to take the Americans and the West in general at their word. And I think Europe is being brutally honest about their intentions in Ukraine. But I think it's a mixed bag from the Americans. I think as this moment settles in, if you're Russian, if you're in Russian leadership, you have to ask the question if America's being straight with you or not, to some degree, whether it's lasting or not. Kremlin, and this is from just yesterday, Kremlin welcomes Rubio's Russia Day message as very positive news. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio congratulated the Russian people on Russia Day, celebrated on June 12th, while vowing to work toward reaching a resolution of the Ukraine conflict. That's very welcome, because this is where the danger is. If Iran's been decapitated and there's nothing there to defend, it's one more, I can't call it satellite state, but it's one more layer of the onion peeled away from the Asiatic powers trying to counterbalance Western hegemony. Trump came to power on a nationalist message on extricating America from global conflict and dealing with America's internal domestic problems, ending the war in Ukraine and trying to prevent war elsewhere. I have to wonder if the current operation against Iran undermines that, undermines their message, undermines their opponent's ability to trust them in good faith. And we'll see. I don't know the answer. I'm just a guy with a camera thinking about things. But I do have to wonder if you're Russia, how does this all look from your perspective? Now, it's interesting. China's come out, and everything I've read on China's statement about this operation indicates to me that China's not going to get involved. They've got their own problems. The Russians are incapable of getting involved, and if Iran has been successfully decapitated or near decapitated, they're not going to. I mean, it disincentivizes involvement, direct involvement on their part. You're still dealing with the fact that the regime can probably maintain itself in Iran for who knows how long, absent some kind of occupation force. There's one more tweet I want to discuss in a little bit more detail, and that is, the complacency bias so prevalent today reminds me of everything I read about the Western world in 1914. Crazy to think that was 111 years ago. No one living remembers, too few read history, and fewer still understand its implications. Prior to the start of the First World War, it was hard to find somebody in Europe who thought that that conflagration was going to proceed. But it's not the start of the war that really gets me. It's how the war proceeded and how the myths of the war shaped the future. So, Germany and Austria-Hungary were painted as the villains of the First World War. I've always maintained there were no villains in the First World War. There was an alliance system. And that alliance system brought everybody in. Everybody kept their word. Everybody said that under certain circumstances they would go to war, and they did. I don't see either side as being good or evil in the First World War. What happened, the way things transpired, I mean, it's hard to not see the mass useless death of so many people as anything short of evil. And if it's not evil, it's part of anthropological procedure. It's what humans do. We do this periodic bloodletting through warfare. We just have this problem right now that we can't do it on that scale anymore because of the advent of nuclear weapons. It changes things, which is why, from Israel's perspective and America's perspective, Iran couldn't be allowed to have nuclear weapons. But the fact remains that America and Israel have been talking about Iran being a hair's breadth away from nuclear weapons for the last 30 years. It's always been the sword of Damocles hanging over everybody. They don't have them. And I think that's one of the things about the Iranian regime. I don't see how they could ever actively pursue getting them, because the response would be total destruction and annihilation. But they're already there from their perspective. The regime's already there from their perspective. And I digress anyway. World War I was conducted, and the Central Powers lost. And they were painted as evil and aggressors. And so there was the Versailles Treaty. And further, in the 1920s, there was Locarno, which set up the interwar world. Now, at the time, they didn't know it was the interwar world. Versailles placed these punitive, unrealistic burdens on Germany in terms of reparations for the war, which they couldn't possibly hope to pay, which created the subsequent conditions for the rise of the NSDAP. But before there was Versailles, and before there was Locarno, there was this myth that they were the bad actors in the First World War, when it was really just another great power war, competing interests. But that's what we do. We have stories, we have myths that we create. And then, you know, I haven't been doing much, because I don't have the energy to do much right now. So one evening, while lying around on the couch, my wife and I watched Oppenheimer, which is a modern movie, and I'm not a fan of modern movies. I don't like how they're filmed. I find they're short on substance and big on CGI, and everything's too quick and fragmented, and I don't know if that's just symbolic of a younger mind these days in the age of TikTok, but I digress. It actually turned out, for the subject matter, it was a fairly good flick. I could pick it apart and parse it, but I don't really need to. Not for the purposes of this. The most poignant scene for me, at least in terms of my thought processes, was towards the end. It talks about this bomber that's flying to Germany to bomb Germany. And from the windows of the bomber, they saw these V2 rockets. Nobody knew what the V2s were at the time except for the Germans flying toward London. And few at the time could have had the vision to understand that the combination of what came out of the Manhattan Project and those V2s would create a Gordian knot for the world. It would essentially be the end of great power warfare, direct warfare. Because to engage in direct warfare is to necessitate the use of nuclear weapons. It just, there's something about it. I've actually been struggling to put words on how haunting that scene was for me. But all that is to say, the complacency bias that we have now assumes that nothing bad can ever happen, that everything's planned and in control, and the age of unpredictable outcome is over, that we are in fact in a post-historical era. I see this all the time. People say that nuclear war could never happen. Nobody would be stupid enough to do it. And as I've noted in other videos, it's not priced into the markets. Nobody prices it in because I think it's so devastating if it happens that nothing else will matter anyway. You're going to go from worrying about yield on bonds or stock returns to worrying about how much storable food you have and if you've got enough protection between you and the outside world for the fallout. And this is why I say the world is in the most dangerous place it's ever been in. Because the great powers are fighting proxy wars against each other all over the place. And many of them are nuclear armed. There's a lot of pressure. There's food pressure. There's resource pressure. There's collapsing trade arrangements and relationships. Specifically, I'm thinking of between Russia and Europe that should not be allowed to collapse. The expansion of NATO and the prosecution of the Ukraine war, which Ukraine is losing slowly in spite of all the interventions. Russia is advancing. They're advancing piece by piece. It's Ukraine's war to lose. And in spite of Ukraine, with Western backing, and this is the key. The Ukraine was successful in striking Russia's strategic bomber fleet and causing a high degree of damage and changing, with one attack, Russia's posturing. They're having to rethink their nuclear strategy in real time. They did that with the help of Western nations, probably the Americans as well. If the Americans were willing to lie to Iran about the impending Israeli assault, if the Americans were willing to plan that assault hand in hand with Israel while signaling that they were not, if on the very day the Secretary of State Rubio comes out and says, we have nothing to do with this, only to be contradicted the next day by Donald Trump and reality setting in, does that not undermine the ability of Russia and China to take the Americans at their word?